Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. This week, I'm talking with designer and illustrator Mitch Goldstein. We chat about being dialed into architecture early on in undergrad, before him being asked to take an extended break from college. How getting into RISD changed his life and led him to where he is now. How teaching has helped him continue learning and expand his private practice. How the overuse of design as problem solving is a self-aggrandizing dialogue, and more, all right after this. It's no secret that I love Jack Prince. They're a longtime sponsor of the podcast and Creative South. Plus, they do great work. Whether they're making our pop-up displays and tablecloths or printing notebooks, Jack Prince is always there when we need them. This year, they are printing new Creative South t-shirts for me and the podcast stickers. They have a coupon code on the back that gives you a great discount on all of their products, just in time for Creative South. Speaking of stickers, Jack Prince will print any kind, shape, size, or stock, including full-color stickers with full-color liner prints, for you to use as product labels, promotions, bumper stickers, hang tags, business cards, and more. Right now, you can get 500 3x3-inch die-cut stickers, starting at $149. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South Podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. If you like the Creative South Podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South Podcast swag. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, a shout out on the podcast thanking you for your support, Creative South Podcast stickers and t-shirts. So please help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Mitch, thanks for joining me this morning.
Happy to be here, Jason.
So let's start from the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. I just say Providence because nobody except people from Rhode Island know Rhode Island, but it's this little sort of town called East Greenwich, which is like maybe 15 minutes south of Providence. But really in Rhode Island,
so the suburbs.
Like Providence. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much everything is a suburb of Providence. So I grew up there, and originally I went to, you know, right out of high school, I went to Syracuse University for school, which mm-hmm. was for architecture, and that was a huge unsuccessful experience. But it was unsuccessful in that I didn't graduate with an architecture degree, which in retrospect, thank goodness that happened, because I would be just an excruciatingly bad, or I would be a horrible, horrible architect. I love architecture and I still love architecture, but it was really very much not what I should be doing with my life. So
sure.
At the time it sucked, but when I was, you know, I mean, I like to say that we agreed to have me leave, but really they were like, you need to go.
Oh, I had that experience when I started college too.
Yeah.
I did a couple of freshman years, and after the really first full year of it, they agreed I should take a break.
Yeah. Yeah. We mutually agreed me being there wasn't the best move.
Yeah.
And so, you know, after I kind of, you know, I left, that was tough. I mean, obviously I was, you know, 21, 22, all of a sudden, mm-hmm. like my sort of future career was non-existent. Mm-hmm. And so I pretty much just noodled around with a lot of retail sales jobs. Nothing really interesting, kind of just pretty much just wasting time. I mean, I think I sort of grew as like a human being to some extent, but it was really not any kind of creative work or anything really interesting.
Sure.
And eventually I started doing some fine art stuff, started doing some painting stuff, things like that. Slowly kind of dialed in to start doing some web work with a couple of friends. Eventually mm-hmm. that turned into a small little media company, which I, you know, kind of worked for a year or two. And by the time I hit around, I must have been about 30, you know, no degree, kind of like limited options, basically.
Uh-huh.
And my dad and I had a chat, and he's like, you really need to go to school. And I'm like, you know, don't be an asshole. Come on. Like, you know, it's really, you know, don't give me that. He's like, no, seriously, you really need to, you need to kind of rethink about it. And you know, and I kind
of was that one of those conversations of, I know he's right, but I don't want him telling me that he's right.
Yeah. I thought he's like, you know, just go. Like, it's only money and time and your life. Like, no problem. I'm like, oh, that's all I have to do is go back to school. How easy. But sure. Then I really sat down and kind of looked at it and decided it was actually something to try to do. And so I applied to a couple schools and ended up getting into RISD, which was great because I was right there. And there it is. And then from there, everything else kind of happened.
Gotcha. Well, let's back up a little bit. And since you started off at architecture school, when you were growing up, what were you into?
I think it was kind of normal kid stuff. I was definitely,
I would hope that was there.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, right. I was definitely into like Lincoln Logs and Erector sets and stuff like that. So I grew up as a little kid in the 70s.
Sure.
So 70s into early 80s. Yeah. So, you know, there was like an Atari 2600, like the original Atari, stuff like that. So obviously all that stuff. But I think that I think it's pretty easy to say, well, I played with Lincoln Logs, therefore I wanted to be an architect. But I really did play with Lincoln Logs, and I really did, by the time I was maybe 8 or 9 or 10, want to be an architect. Like, I kind of knew that was the direction I was going. Uh-huh. And all through, you know, junior high and high school, I mean, that was what I wanted to do. Like, there was no real debate about the future career at all.
Sure. So it wasn't so much, I mean, not that there wasn't art involved, but it wasn't, artistic pursuits were not your focus when you were growing up.
Yeah, I would say it was definitely more architecture. I didn't do any, like, you know, I did sort of like, you know, high school art class, but it was nothing really hardcore. I had always been pretty dialed into architecture, really, from since I was old enough to like have a sense of a career, since I was a kid, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So
when you get through high school, you go to Syracuse.
Yep.
That ends up not working out.
Not at all.
Like I said, I know that feeling well.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you dropped out, kicked out.
Right.
and you're, like you said, noodling around. At what point does the kind of picking up some web design and things like that is getting out of the retail world pick up? How does that fall in your lap?
I'm trying to remember exactly how it happened. I was friendly with a bunch of people in Providence, and we kind of hung out at like the local coffee shop, like the local bohemian, you know, coffee shop.
Sure.
And just through just hanging out and kind of being there, you know, I work retail. So it was kind of like, you know, you go sell computers for 8 hours and then you go grab a coffee or whatever. Uh-huh. I became friends with this guy, Jason Pommenthal, who a lot of people probably know. He does a lot of speaking and web things and typography things on the internet now. And it was him and I and a couple other guys. And he had been doing a lot of early web stuff in like the late 90s.
Sure.
And I just was like, oh, that's cool. Like, you can, you know, like make visual stuff, but like for a living, like not like, you know, art and like wait tables and make a painting and maybe sell it 20 years, but like you can actually have like sort of a career. And so I think as long as you use tables. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This was definitely way old school stuff.
Hey, I remember those days.
Yeah. And, you know, he had been doing his own kind of freelance business, and I gave him a hand on a couple of things he needed. And eventually it just developed into, he really wanted to kind of open a little studio. And I obviously was like, that sounds great. Like, I would love to do that. And so it was, you know, him and a couple other people and myself, and we just had like a little office, and he had, you know, it's all him. I mean, I didn't have any clients. It was all coming from him.
Sure.
And so we did that. I don't remember quite how long that lasted. I think it was about a year and change. And then I was like, you know, I need to like up this game, basically. You know, like, I'm clearly not like I'm not understanding enough about this thing called visual design. And it's going to be a problem. Like, I can kind of like noodle my way through it a little bit, but really it's like, I'm not where I want to be. And that's when it was kind of like, I had this chat with my dad about maybe going back to school, and it just kind of went from there.
And your dad pissed you off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you decided, I'll show him
and I'll go do this. And there you go.
And he was like, good.
Yeah. He's like, exactly. See how that worked.
So at this point you go to RISD And, you know, I realize, you know, it's kind of in your backyard at the, but that's not exactly the, you know, slacker of schools to get into, no. Especially after having, you know, dropped out of your first experience in college. It's
right.
It's even then it was a really prestigious school for design.
Oh, yeah. And it was kind of a funny story because I basically was not financially in a place where I could like move somewhere else. You know, it sure. needed to be a kind of commute from Providence. So fortunately, you know, Providence is pretty close to Boston. There's a ton of colleges in that kind of part of the country. Mm-hmm. But I basically said, you know, I'll apply to sort of the local college called Rhode Island College, which is a great school, mm-hmm. Has a graphic design program. And I'm like, you know, I feel fairly confident I will. It's not what you would call a selective design school. I was like, sure. I will probably get in. It will be reasonably cheap because it is I'm in state and it's in state tuition. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, what the hell? I might as well throw in for RISD because why not? I already have the application together. It's just, you know, you do a bicycle drawing and you kind of get, you know. And so I was like, what the hell? And so I applied for both. And I ended up not getting into Rhode Island College, which was kind of surprising. And I did get into RISD, and RISD gave me a lot of financial help. They gave me a lot of scholarship and grant. And so it kind of made it feasible to go.
And it was unbelievable. Because it's not feasible to go now.
Oh, yeah. It's insanely expensive then, and it's still insanely expensive. And it really was not an option without a lot of sort of scholarship and gift from them. And, you know, I don't know really exactly what happened, but I was told by one of the faculty that they really liked that I was older and that, you know, because at this point I was basically 31. Mm-hmm. And they really liked that I was older and they really liked that I was clearly kind of independent, you know, like my parents weren't on my financial aid form. It was just me, you know, stuff like that.
Sure.
And so for whatever reason, they gave me this shot, which was, again, I was flabbergasted. I mean, I can't verbally explain how floored I was that I got in.
Yeah.
It was such a, like a no way. It was like a lottery ticket. I mean, it was just not something that was ever going to happen. And it really, I really can't credit RISD enough with how much it changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
when you get to RISD, do you start focusing on any specific aspects of design or, I mean, I realize, you know, you get in and you kind of got to take fundamentals and then decide from there. But once you get to the point where you're deciding on stuff, did you focus on anything specific or?
Well, I knew I wanted to do graphic design, mm-hmm. based on the sort of, you know, webby things I had been doing, and spending a little time kind of thinking about like sort of a major and the place I wanted to focus. I knew that, you know, graphic design was the broad area that I wanted to go in. That was the major I wanted to go in. But it took a little while once I got there to actually, sort of dial into what within graphic design I was really particularly interested in, mm-hmm. Because as you know, graphic design is such a massive word. It's almost meaningless. I mean, I think it actually is meaningless nowadays because it's so everything. It's just, it doesn't mean, it's like saying food. It's just, it's everything, you know?
Yes.
And so, you know, getting into RISD at first, it was just like, you know, sort of taking the sort of foundational classes and the drawing class and all that stuff, and then very basic things and basic type and all that kind of thing. And eventually I kind of dialed into where my work has gone now, and into the kinds of things that I got excited about. Over the course of, I ended up going for 3 years because I had some transfer credits and I did like a summer pre-college thing. And
sure.
You know, so I kind of did, I kind of didn't quite have to do 4 full years. I did like 3.5 years.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And when you're getting close to graduation, had you decided at that point that you wanted to continue on and do your master's?
Not at all. I really thought that a master's was so not even a conversation. It was so outside of reality for me. But what had happened at RISD was I had started being a teaching assistant. And teaching was mm-hmm. never something that was in my head at all. Like it was never even a thing I thought I wanted to do. And then I had very kind of jokingly said to one of my faculty, oh, if you ever need a TA, you know, let me know. And the faculty was like, okay, you can do that. And I said, no, I was kidding. Like, I don't have any business being a TA. He's like, no, you can do it. And I started being a teaching assistant pretty much every semester I was at RISD. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like mm-hmm. I this is a thing people do for a living. And that's when I got really excited about teaching.
Okay.
In addition to being sort of a practitioner, the teaching got really something I was really getting into, and I was having a lot of chats with the faculty about sort of, you know, what it means to develop a pedagogy and all that kind of stuff. And so I knew when I kind of left RISD, if I ever wanted to be a full-time educator, that a master's degree would probably be something I would need to do. But
sure.
It was just so like, how do you even do it? Like, I don't even get how you could go do that. It's not free. You know, I mean, there's money and time and all this stuff. And so it really just kind of wasn't even a chat. I had met my now wife at school. We were in school together and we were just like, let's work and let's just get going and, you know, kind of see where we go. And mm-hmm. grad school was just not even, it was just gone. It was like, yeah, whatever. We're not even going to talk about it. and we just kind of worked and we immediately started working together. I graduated in 2006 and she graduated in 2007 and we immediately started just doing client work.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm curious about that because my wife is a graphic designer as well. And mm-hmm. I mean, we've been married, it'll be 13 years in January. Yep. And wait, it's 13 or 14. I need math.
Yeah.
It was in 2006. I know what year. So okay, yeah, 13 years. Yeah. But we just really in the past year have started working together mm-hmm. on doing graphic design. So what at that point, you know, made you think, you know, I can have, you know, a personal relationship and a professional relationship with this person and not get sick of them or want to murder them in one aspect of things?
I didn't. I thought, okay. There is no way I'm doing this. I love you. There is no way I'm going to work with you. We will kill each other. Uh-huh. I'm not going to ruin our relationship for a paycheck. And she's like, no, we'll be fine. And she was right. I mean, basically, I think that my wife, Ann Jordan, and I, the reason why Ann and I work together so well is we're very good at very different things.
Sure.
And so we're not really overlapping and kind of butting into each other. You know, we're not like smacking into each other in ways. It's like all the holes I'm not good at, she knows how to do, and all the holes she's not good at, I know how to do. Uh-huh. And so it really worked really, really well in that respect. And it was really obvious pretty quickly once we started. Basically, like I had freelance clients, she had freelance clients, and it was like, why not just open a studio? You know, okay. There was no business plan. It was just like, this is stupid. Like, let's just work together. And I was really like, no. And then like in a month we had opened a business, you know, we were like, okay, obviously we'll just do this.
Gotcha.
And it's worked really well. I mean, obviously we still work together. So it's been tremendous.
And you're still married. So.
Yep. Oh yeah, definitely.
That's yeah. The more important one.
That's which is really the success. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you're going through, you're working with Anne and mm-hmm. building things up. You've already kind of in your mind thought, you know, if I want to ever teach, you know, grad school is a thing I need to do. Mm-hmm. What was the tipping point that made you decide, you know what, I need to do this?
That's a good question. I think we had, you know, we had a number of clients. I think we were doing good work. I don't think we were doing like brilliant work. I think we were doing very, very good graphic design. Clients were generally very happy. We were paying all of our bills. We made actually a pretty good living. You know, we were doing well. Mm-hmm. But the work itself was just not at the place I wanted it to be. It just wasn't like deep enough. It wasn't, I don't want to say intellectual because that's not really valuable, but it wasn't like, I feel like
stimulating.
Yeah. I guess that's a way to think about it. There wasn't enough kind of going on in the work itself. And so we were like, well, how is that going to ever elevate? And also I like, you know, at this point I had been teaching as part-time forever. Like I'd been having 1 to 3 classes a semester at one or two schools, teaching. And I was like, you know, I do want to teach, like clearly I love teaching and this is something I definitely want to do. How are we going to do this? Like, how are we going to elevate the work? How are we going to get being a full-time educator? And really the answer to that for us was graduate school. Like that was the thing that kind of had to happen. Mm-hmm. And so we looked around at a couple of different schools. We narrowed in on Virginia Commonwealth University School of the Arts mm-hmm. and Cranbrook, visited both, talked to both. And at the end of the day, we ended up going to VCU. A lot of it was financial. I mean, I love, love, love Cranbrook, and I absolutely love Elliot Earls, who runs the program there.
Sure.
But VCU, being a sort of state institution, had a ton of money. And we ended up getting to go for basically nothing. They kind of covered all the tuition, gave us a stipend. And we both got in, we both went at the same time, which was, again, another, like, how did that really happen? Kind of, you know, how is that possible? And so we both got to go, and we both went, I think, fall of 2010 or fall of 11. I always screw the math up in my head.
Sure.
and yeah. And so we both went to school for the 2 years at VCU, which was phenomenal. I mean, we learned just the work just got so much better. Our work got much better and much more interesting from that experience. And the added bonus was now I was qualified to be a full-time educator. You know, that master's degree almost always is what you need. Not totally always, but almost always.
Sure.
And yeah, and so then we went kind of from there.
Gotcha. So, you know, as you're going through the program, what about the way you thought about design and the way you thought about how you approached your work changed?
Boy, that's a big question. I think
we got
that,
time.
Yeah, I think that I have a very, how do I answer this? That's good. I have like a very specific approach to the work, and I fully respect people who sort of look at graphic design as problem solving.
Sure.
I understand why people say that. I thoroughly don't care about that. I very much don't care about problem solving in my work at all. Now, I do think that if that is what you care about, you should totally care about it. And it is a totally legit way to approach what you do. I really look at work.
I'm laughing because I agree with you. I mean, yeah. I think there are aspects of it that are problem solving.
Right.
But that is not the overall goal of what it should be.
Not at all. And I really think that my work sits sort of in between a sort of fine art practice and a graphic design practice.
Sure.
And anybody who's ever heard me say anything knows that I don't really care about those distinctions. I just don't, it doesn't matter. Like, is art and design different? Yes. And I could care. I don't care. It doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
So I think that what I learned at kind of RISD was to develop a design practice that's a little bit more personal, a little bit more sort of expressive. I don't remember who said, if this was like Aggie Toppins who said it on your podcast the other day, but it was like sort of like finding problems rather than, I hope I'm not misquoting whoever said that. I might be screwing that up. But somebody, I just recently heard somebody explain it as finding problems, not solving problems. And I really agree with that. I kind of like this idea of sort of inventing these like situations for myself.
Sure.
That I then kind of process through to make the work. And so that's kind of where I got to. I took a really important class, must have been my sophomore year at RISD with this professor, Franz Werner, who taught a class called Photographics. And what it was about sort of photography and typography mixed together.
Uh-huh.
So like taking photos of typography, not like a picture of a dog and then putting type on it, but sort of making typography and design through camera as a tool. And that was a really profound, that really opened up my brain when I took that class. And I'm like, wait a minute, you mean I can like take pictures of stuff? What do you, I don't get it. Like, I don't, you know, and that was a really important moment for me. And then the other really big thing that happened was I got to become friends with Nancy Skolos and Tom Woodell, who taught at RISD. Nancy at the time was the department head. Tom is like a senior lecturer, and they also have a very, very incredible practice. They recently got an AIGA medal a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had them, and a lot of how they're working is they are sort of making these like physical objects, which are then photographed and sort of digitally processed to make their posters.
Sure.
And I had never thought like, oh, you can do like actual stuff you can actually touch and then sort of synthesize it with these digital tools and do stuff. And so I think that those kind of two things happened, and that has really directed where the practice has gone for me. And so that's how I approach the work, for better or for worse. I mean, sometimes what I do sucks, but that's, you know, that's okay. It
happens to all of us.
It happens to all of us, right?
Yeah.
But that's kind of become really the direction that Ann and I have developed, and all of the kind of collaborative book cover work we do now sits in that space. It all sits in that kind of hybrid place between art, design, photography, and sort of physical models and things like that.
Sure. I had kind of a similar experience with the, I guess you can almost call it reverse processing.
Yeah.
For what graphic design is, of, you know, the taking the picture of something and then working it. And it, mine came out of, I was doing stuff for a friend's band. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were two things. There was absolutely no budget. I mean, I was just doing it because they were friends. And I wanted to create a specific look. And this was probably 10 years ago. Yeah. And I had no idea like how I could do that on the computer.
Right.
Like, I could not figure it out. So it was, I started taking a bunch of pictures and I would, you know, hand collage them together. And then I was like, I want to have this distressed look. So I got a piece of sandpaper and like went over there and then like was scanning it and adding stuff to it that way. And that was kind of how it taught me to look at that aspect and see things from a different point of view. Because it was literally, I couldn't figure out how, you know, now I know how to do it on the computer and,
right,
you know, I can do it in half the time. But, you know, 10 years ago, you know, Kyle Webster's brushes didn't exist and I wasn't able to do what I wanted to do and was seeing in my head. So it forced me into that kind of realm.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you're wrapping up grad school and those things, you know, kind of all coalesce and come together, I guess as you're wrapping up, do you start looking for teaching jobs, or was your goal to still go back into, I mean, not that you don't still have your, you know, your studio practice, but was it to just go back into that? And then if teaching stuff came about?
No, we actually decided pretty hard when we agreed to sort of go to grad school, we knew that the outcome was going to be finding a teaching job. Like, okay. That was the goal, was to exit VCU with a job teaching.
Okay.
And so we both ended up looking and we both got some offers and we both found some stuff, but Anne actually ended up getting the best offer, which was at Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore.
Good school.
And so we took that job, you know, Anne took that job. I took sort of an adjunct position at the same school. Mm-hmm. And we went to Baltimore and we did that for a year. And I was not, I mean, Monica is an amazing school. It was great, but I wanted to really be full time and there just wasn't a job there for me. It wasn't because I was not good. It just didn't exist. You know, the position was not there. And so Anne and I had a really long debate about kind of the future, and I really needed to be a full-time faculty somewhere. And so we agreed to kind of let's open up the search again. And I found this amazing position at Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York. And mm-hmm. we agreed to take it. You know, we both said what's going to be best for the family, not for Mitch, not for Ann, but for us together. And we agreed that it would be better to be in Rochester at RIT with me being like a tenure-track faculty member. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we did. So I took the job, and, you know, very, very graciously fulfilled her contract with Micah. She was on a 2-year contract.
Sure.
So the first year, which was awful, was I was in Rochester and she was in Baltimore.
Yeah, that's gotta suck.
It was horrible. And anybody who knows Ann and I, like, we are so dependent on each other. It was not super fun. Like, it was not like, oh, cool, I'm a bachelor. It was a nightmare. And she would fly up every weekend and it was
out of curiosity, do you all have kids?
No.
No.
We very, very consciously decided to go dogs instead of kids.
Yeah. I was about to say, because, I mean, well, A, it's hard enough to leave dogs, but if you've got actual kids, it's immensely harder. And not to, it's not like downgrading anyone's dog. I've had pets, but I also have children now, and there is a huge difference.
Oh, unquestionably, which is why we don't have them.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so then, you know, I came to RIT. It's a tenure track position.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. And, you know, Baltimore is an amazing city, but I am just, as much as I think I'm supposed to want to be in a big city, cause I'm a designer, I just don't like big cities. I like visiting big cities, but I don't want to live in a huge city. Providence was about as big of a city as I kind of ever need to be in. And so between like sort of the life in Rochester and the life in Baltimore, Rochester for us was much better just as a life, just as a, you know, an existence. And so it just all made sense. Like, there was no real negative. I mean, it all kind of worked out. Anne really loved teaching and was brilliant at it, but she also loves creative practice as well. So for her, it was you know, equally valuable to not teach and to do sort of the design stuff. Yeah, and that's kind of where we're at now.
Gotcha. And how long have you been up there now? You've been up there, what, about this, 4 years?
Good question. I just finished my fifth year. So this coming fall is my sixth year at RIT. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, in that time, you know, how, especially through teaching, because I'm going to butcher the old saying, but it, basically the best way to learn something is to teach it. How have you grown in your design practice through teaching design to students?
Oh, infinitely large. Infinite. I mean, completely. I think that the sort of not secret secret about teaching is that I learn, I think, probably more than my students do.
Sure.
From the process of being an educator. And at least for me personally, and I can't speak for all educators, but my sort of creative practice, my kind of writing and research practice, my kind of dialogue and podcasting and stuff I've done in the past practice, and my teaching activity all circle into each other. They're not really separate things.
Sure.
That doesn't mean I'm literally taking my client work into class and saying, let's do this together. I will take your, you know.
Hello, you're my intern now.
Yeah.
and you're paying for it.
Yeah, exactly. But it absolutely... It completely and totally feeds each other, unquestionably.
Sure.
And so I have grown massively, massively from doing that. And I continue to grow. And that's what's so great about being, I mean, there's so many things that are great about it, but amongst them are that I am constantly, you know, having ideas or having sort of visual things I'm working on in my own practice, in my own kind of whatever, what we're going to call quote unquote fine art practice.
Sure.
And then those ideas kind of sit back into sort of projects and discussions with the students. And then the students sort of find things to ask questions about. And then those questions make me ask questions, and it's just infinite. It's phenomenal.
Gotcha. So you mentioned something a while back, and you kind of touched on it again. You don't delineate a ton between, I mean, obviously, cognitively, you know, there's a difference between design and fine art, but you try not to delineate between the two and use that as a crossover. How did that come about for you?
I'm not totally certain about that. I think I've always had legs in both, I guess. You know, sure. I have done sort of fine art before I went to school. I've done some painting and things like that. I guess for me, I think, I'm not sure. That's a good question. I kind of feel like words get in the way of things a lot of times. And I think that being able to sort of verbalize either through the written word or through the spoken word, kind of what it is we do as creative practitioners is actually very valuable and very important. And I think it helps solidify what we're thinking about, if you kind of then write it or talk about it. So I actually think that's a really valuable part of the creative process, is the sort of analysis and the kind of like wrangling the stuff together. And obviously as an educator, part of what I do every day is explain what I'm doing or what a student's doing.
Sure.
But I also think that words are very easy to hide behind. And I think that words are very much a like protective shield. And I kind of feel like, at least for me, that designers are very fragile people for some reason. I think we have, Yeah, and I'm in this. I'm not saying I'm not. I'm totally right there with everybody else. But we're very fragile.
Yes.
And we have this really weird, I think I refer to it as arrogant insecurity.
That is a good description. I've been trying to figure out a way to explain it. I've been explaining it as, I have a very healthy ego, but I am completely insecure about having an ego.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good too. And so what, again, and this is, I'll say these things and they're not absolute statements. They're just my experience. But like, I think that designers hide behind, I'm a problem solver. And they say, look how important I am. I'm solving problems. Well, you know what? Picking a typeface for a poster isn't solving a problem. It's just not a problem.
No,
you're not solving a problem. I mean, I'm sorry, but you're just not, that's not a problem. So I just think that frame is very self-aggrandizing, and it's very, in a way, sort of masturbatory, that I find very, it's very disingenuous to me. Mm-hmm. And so where I'm going with that is that I think we can like hide behind these words. I have had so many people tell me that what I do is just art in like a very dismissive sort of like, it's just art, so whatever. And I'm thinking like, dude, you just gave me the biggest compliment you possibly could. If you think my work is just mm-hmm. art, I am so happy to hear that. Other people will hear me say that. Yeah. Other people hear me say it and think this guy's like just this flaky art guy. Like he's not a designer. And I'm like, fine. If that makes you fall asleep at night, you're right. I'm not a designer. Like, I don't care. It doesn't matter. What mm-hmm. matters is the stuff, like the stuff, both the visual artifacts, the sort of dialogue around the stuff. That's the stuff that matters. But mm-hmm. sort of having this kind of defensive mechanism about art versus design, I think it's petty. It doesn't accomplish anything. And it just doesn't matter. And so I'm not going to deny someone what they think. I just don't care. Sure. I'm not saying they're not different. I'm saying I don't care what the difference is. It hasn't gotten me anywhere. You know, those distinctions haven't accomplished anything for me personally.
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, people trying to define what's the difference and the problem solving conversations and all that stuff has, I mean, I think you can almost reflect that to the divisions that are going on, you know, like with politics and things like that. That, I mean, you're very active on Twitter. I'm pretty active on Twitter, and you, like, if you look on there, you see it all the time, and it's this, just everything has to be black and white online, and if you don't agree with me, then you're an evil person, and it's
right.
It's become that way in the design world too, and I think that's just so, I'm going to cuss, so fucking stupid.
Yeah, it's totally, it's just, I, you know, I have such a love-hate relationship with social media. I really do.
Yeah.
I have gotten so many meetings with people and gotten to interact with people that I would never, ever, ever, ever get to talk to. I've had so many incredible sort of real life, you know, like meetups and things with people that I have met online.
Sure.
But then it's also this like toxic cesspool at the same time.
Oh God. Yeah.
And it's the design Twitter is a kind of a nightmarish hell sometimes.
Yeah.
And I really think that, I think you got to kind of ask yourself, if your inclination is to see a piece of work and shit on it, why is that doing anything for you? Like, what is that accomplishing for you? I think that, again, we're fragile and we always feel marginalized for whatever reason. That's how we feel. I don't know why. That's how we seem to feel. Mm-hmm. And so being able to kind of crap on a designer's work or somebody's opinion or any number of things, I guess, can make you feel better. I guess it doesn't make me feel better. It makes me feel much worse.
Oh, yeah.
And honestly, I have even stopped being political because it's too excruciating, just the world right now. And I don't know what everybody's politics are. And you're allowed to believe what you believe, but I very clearly have an opinion on this. And, and it's just, it's such a toxic shithole that I don't want to add to toxicness. Having said that, I do think critical dialogue is insanely important. And I do think that while your ego feels good if everybody just cheerleads you, you need people to really say, no, you know, what you're doing isn't right. And here's, let's talk about it. Or here's why this piece of design isn't working. And mm-hmm. here's my reaction to it, or things like that. So I think critical dialogue is insanely important. It is not, it's past important. It's more important than just important. It's a necessity for the practice. But shitting on people is not critical dialogue. And so I have really...
there's a huge difference.
There's a huge difference. Yeah.
Offering that critical dialogue and critiquing something than there is criticizing something.
Exactly. And that's why what I have found, and maybe this is just me, maybe this is just the Twitter sort of reality I've invented for myself, but I find true critical dialogue a little difficult on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
I think that maybe introducing people who can then have critical dialogue is great on Twitter, but I think the actual back and forth is very minimal. And again, maybe that's just me online. Maybe other people can get amazing back and forth. I have found it a little kind of hard to find through all the other stuff. But, you know, whatever. Like, it's fine. I had somebody, I can't remember when this was, somebody gave me a real attitude on Twitter about how I was telling people how to act and telling people what to do. And I'm like, no, if you think that I'm like dictating how people should behave, you're out of your mind. I am talking about what works for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of sharing it with people because for whatever reason, people seem to want to hear what I have to say, which again is,
oh yeah,
frankly surprising every day that people give a crap about what I think. But I think that's valuable. Like, I want to know how people do what they do and how they think about it. But I'm not going to ever be told what to do. Similarly, I very much hope people don't look at what I say as like the law, because it is in no way that. It's just one dude's opinion, you know?
Sure. Well, I've started doing that too. And it's funny because I'm in October, I'm giving my first talk since college, which I'm
great.
I'm still shitting bricks about.
That's good.
I'm in the process of writing it, and I got like, I don't know, maybe like I got past the working out the outline and all that stuff. And I'm like, I'm trying to write it like I would write a paper, just so I have a framework and then I can go from there. But right. You know, I started writing everything in second person, where everything's, and then you, and then you, and then you. Mm-hmm. And it just dawned on me, like, after about two pages worth of writing, it was like, no, this is me. This comes off as me telling someone how to do that. So I literally wrote in a disclaimer. I'm going to be saying the words you, but I really mean this is how I did this.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, I am tweeting for me.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds very self-absorbed, but it's actually a way to solidify my ideas.
Yeah.
And so, you know, half of my Twitter account is stupid meme-y bullshit, which is fun and funny. And, you know, it's fun to do meme, you know, it's fun. And half of it is really very sincere, really serious things that I am genuinely either interested in or struggling with or trying to understand. And again, the value of sharing it is hopefully it will spark an idea in someone else and then they can kind of run with whatever. What I hope it is not doing is acting as sort of some kind of rule book, because it is in no way that. It is absolutely not that. And I very much hope people aren't thinking that's what's going on, because it's really not. That's not what it's about at all.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you get those, you know, by the time you're 35, you should.
Oh, yeah. It's like it's.
Or, crazy. You know, the 10 things successful people do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's I mean, you know. I really think, and every time I say this, people give me an attitude like I'm totally full of crap, which is, you know, I may be. But I tell people, like, look, you know, my advice to you is stop looking for advice and go figure some shit out.
Yeah.
Like, just go do it. And they're like, but you're Twitter. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Like, I know. But I'm figuring it out. Like, that's the whole point, is that I'm trying to figure it out as much as anybody does. And that's what I've really learned, having gotten to meet a lot of people and gotten to talk to a lot of people, is nobody has it figured out.
No.
And so this idea of imposter syndrome, I reject that as an idea. I call it being a human being, because that is what the human condition is to be imposter syndrome 24/7. I just think that's how it is. And I think it's kind of beautiful, and I think it's kind of wonderful. And I think that being like confused and unsure of yourself, it's such a great thing to do, I think, inside the work. Although I have to admit, being confused and unsure of myself in like life is very stressful. And I actually much prefer to know exactly what's happening in 6 months rather than being confused. But sure. When you put me inside the work, I am a chaotic nightmare. And I think that's the best possible way to approach the work for me, you know, not for you, but for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of those things that, I mean, I've talked to close to 200 people now through the podcast, and I can count on one hand the amount of people who didn't say they had some sort of imposter syndrome.
Oh,
where
yeah,
they,
I,
you know,
totally.
And, you know, hell, even Draplin said, and people are going to figure out one day that I'm just, you know, ripping off these styles that I saw years ago. Exactly. He's like, I mean, I'm not literally ripping off their work, but. This isn't anything new.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, you know, all these people who everybody thinks has figured it out are just as confused as you. It's okay.
And it's like not even it's not even a secret. It's like just, it's what it is. It's we are in a, again, and I say this in a good way, in an ill-defined, confusing, ambiguous space.
Yes.
Both in terms of our creative practice and in terms of sort of the world right now.
Sure.
And I think you can, either get really irritated and upset about that, or you can kind of lean into it. And it's taken me a while to figure out leaning into it is way more fun.
Like, yeah.
Way, way, way more enjoyable to embrace that ambiguity, embrace that chaos, embrace that uncertainty, because it will get you places that knowing exactly what's going to happen 5 years from now is going to not do for you.
Sure.
And I think when I figured that out, it's like, oh, okay, that's cool. Like, that's fun.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think one of those things, and this goes back to kind of society and all, is, you know, like when you get online and everything is so black and white and so defined and all, I think that partially stems from at this time in the world, things are so much more ambiguous than they ever have been in the past, that people are looking for structure and looking to define something to hang on to, because I don't think our brains have caught up in a way evolutionary wise that we're able to process it properly, and we're struggling to find those ways, and we're trying to define things that we can hold on to.
Right. Yeah, and I would agree with that.
And that doesn't matter what side you're on. I think that's on both sides.
Oh yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. It's a very confusing space right now. And just being alive right now is very challenging for many, many people.
Yes. I completely agree. Yeah. So to get off the social aspect of things, right, and back to the fun art stuff, you know, as you've been able to teach and you've watched your practice grow and you've watched the business grow with your wife, you know, what are some of the things that you've learned along the way that you're able to bring back and incorporate into your life?
That's a very good question. I don't know if I'm that good at life. Like, I'm a much better designer than I am a human being.
I think that's called being a designer.
Yeah. You know, I think that, that's interesting. I'm actually in many ways such polar opposites in sort of like, you know, living versus designing.
Sure.
Inside of design, I'm very chaotic and crazy and really like lean in.
Right.
And then in life, I really like order and control and sort of like very neat things. Like, my office is very specific and very sparse. But then you look at my work and you think, wow, this guy must be a maniac with like what he's doing. And it's sort of funny how I think that I just allow that craziness to come out in the studio, in the design process, and really not in the world. Like, I'm the kind of person, like, in the work, if you said, all right, we've got, you know, a ferret and like a 3D printer and Jell-O, go make some shit, I'd be like, cool, let's go do that. But if you said to me in life,
I'm a little concerned that was the combination that you came up with.
But let's just go with it, you know, let's just go with it, right? I'd be like, sweet. And I'd be all excited and we'd go crank and do some cool stuff. But if you said to me in life, like, hey, I have a free plane ticket to Paris tomorrow, do you want to go? I'd be like, no way. There's no way I can go. I haven't planned it. I don't have my pillow, you know? And so I have this weird bipolarness about, I think, kind of like the you know, life versus the kind of work. And so I don't think like my life is super interesting in that respect. I'm not one of those people who like just jet sets and goes crazy.
Sure.
I feel really good about being in our home studio with my wife and my dogs. Like, that's where I want to be.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was in New York City last week and it's great. And I'm looking around thinking, okay, I get it. Like, I get why this is great. And I'm really glad I don't have to live here, because it's just not for me. Like, I get it, but I'm not the guy who wants to be here.
You know, every time I get in New York, I have that same feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally get it. And I know so many people in New York City. Like, I totally get it. And I'm so glad that the internet exists and I don't have to live here to have clients. You know?
Sure. Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, it's something I wish I could change. I really do wish I could be a lot more sort of spontaneous and a lot less kind of uptight about certain things in sort of life. But it's just not who I am. And I think one of the benefits of getting older is giving less shits about how people perceive you.
Sure. I'm the same way. I am much more of that. It's not that I'm a homebody. It's just that act of control of, I want to be able to plan out all the situations in my head ahead of time and consider every variable so I don't get thrown for a loop.
Exactly.
So, you know, since you kind of have that dichotomy between your personal and professional life, are there times when you're able to, whether it's in design, you know, bring that control that you use in your personal life into that, or vice versa, where it's that where you're able to let that chaos that you do in your design life allow you to be more flexible in your personal life?
I do think that maybe some of the specificity that I have can sit in the work really usefully. You know, a lot of the way we work is we do a million things and then we have to narrow it down to one thing.
Sure.
So we'll do a photo shoot and we'll have literally like 1,000 photos and we have to bring it down to one.
Yeah.
And so I think the control is very useful there. I don't think it goes the other way for me. And it's a problem, like it's something I'm really aware of and I really would like to change. I would like to be more spontaneous. I would like to be a little less uptight about, you know, traveling and things like that. I'm not a great traveler. I mean, I will travel, but I'm not good at it. And so I kind of do think it's a one-way street for me in some ways. And that's something that, I don't know, I would love to change about myself. And I'm, you know, I think being aware of it is a start. At least, you know, I'm like, I like realize that.
Sure.
But yeah, I really think that I do, you know, we can bring in that kind of level of control and intention into the work when it's necessary.
Uh-huh.
And we've learned to know when it's necessary and to not like pre-organize, you know, to do that organization when it's necessary, not before we need it.
So don't
make that's taken time.
So you don't make decisions before they need to be made.
Yeah. I really think that much of what we do is about sort of an, we call it like an emergent process where mm-hmm. the work is, and I know everybody says, well, of course the work comes from the process, but I mean, we really have the vaguest possible notion, the broadest possible sense of what something might maybe do. And we really discover it in the process. And what we don't do is on day one, say, this is what this is going to be. And now we just need to get to that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which again, I think I understand why that happens in design, but that's just not how we do our stuff in any of our work. We really want to sort of set up like a framework of ideation. And then from that framework will result in stuff.
Sure.
And that for us has worked, you know, not for everybody. And I do have to admit it's insanely tedious and like takes forever. You know, it's not efficient, like a way to work. But it gets us kind of where we want to go.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, does Anne have similar processes to you as when it comes to that? Is
oh yeah,
because you guys mentioned you did mention that you're kind of, you know, different as far as style goes and what you're good at and things like that.
Right.
So I'm wondering.
Yeah, I think we sort of have very, very similar approaches. I think our approaches are basically the same at this point. We're so tightly entwined with each other. It's not her approach and my approach. It's our approach. There is
sure.
no me or her. But I think inside of this process, there's sort of these like moments of specificity and moments of ambiguity. And there's times where it's controlled and times where it's chaotic. And like when it needs to be time to do detail and kerning, that's her. And mm-hmm. when it's time to like throw a bunch of crap into a bathtub and take a picture, that's me. And so I think we have learned to, you know, enhance the work through each of our strengths. But I think that our overall kind of, you know, philosophy is the same. It is our philosophy, not mine or hers.
Sure. Now, who has to clean the bathtub after you throw a bunch of shit in it?
Probably me, actually. Yeah.
Good.
Probably me.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. I mean, and I know it's like, oh, we did something with, we did a cover for Print Magazine that used gold leaf,
uh-huh.
which is super cool. And we did this huge, we were like gilding all these paper letters with gold leaf, and we had been finding gold leaf throughout the house for like a year afterwards. It is just impossible to clean it up. And every day there'd be another little fleck of gold leaf on something random. And I don't know like how it got into like the bathroom and the bedroom. Like, I don't know how that happened. We have a studio space, but yeah, it's our work. It's like we kind of strip everything down and then everything's empty. And then we build up all this chaos and then we have to like strip it back down and clean it all up. And it's just kind of the nature of how we work, I guess.
Just keep collecting the gold leaf. It'll come in handy for your retirement,
yeah.
Retirement
we'll
fund.
Yeah, exactly.
Gold Leaf to me is, I mean, I love the look of Gold Leaf, but after the process, it's very much like glitter. It's the herpes of, mm-hmm. you know, the crafting and design world of once you get it, you can't ever get rid of it.
Oh yeah. It's horrible stuff. It's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't use gold. Nobody listening to this should use Gold Leaf for anything. It's a
just be aware of what's going to happen.
Just
afterwards.
FYI. Yeah.
Use protection.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we're getting kind of close to our time, but I'm curious, as you know, moving forward, what are some things that you're looking to do, to kind of expand your voice in the design world? And I'm trying to find the right way to frame that question, but just kind of to grow, I guess.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do a lot more writing. I think that I have gotten to the point in my practice, in my teaching, in sort of my experience as a practitioner and my experience as an educator, where I'm definitely want to do a lot more sort of writing and solidifying these ideas that I've got. So that's kind of thing A that I really want to do more of. I'm committed to doing that. And thing B I want to do more of is my, and I'm air quoting my quote unquote fine arts practice, which for me is sort of a lot of photo darkroom stuff. And sure. So that's the other leg that I really want to expand on and try to really kind of up that to the next level. And then obviously the third leg is kind of the book cover and the publication work that Ann and I do collaboratively. But I've always been missing the, you know, again, what we'll call a fine arts practice. And I've gotten to do it a little bit and I've done some of it for a couple of years, but I really want to step that up. I really need that to be a much more serious aspect of how I spend my time. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the two big things, I think, sort of writing and things like that. And then also this, like sort of the exact opposite of writing, like just the kind of messier, more ambiguous stuff I do in the darkroom.
Sure. Because, yeah, writing's very much about control and mm-hmm. Formulating things. And then
right.
the rest is kind of playing around and just
right.
figuring things out.
Yeah. And seeing how those things kind of hit each other.
Sure.
That's where it gets really interesting for me, is the collision between stuff.
Cool. Well, do you have anything? I know you put on the form that you don't have tons that you can talk about. Do you have anything coming up that you're really looking forward to?
Well, I'm right now submitting all my tenure stuff. So that's really where my brain is right now, is hopefully Good. Getting tenure in a year. but pretty much that. And yeah, I mean, really, I'm going to probably doing some speaking and a couple of things like that. There's always like conferences and stuff that come up, which I love going to. Mm-hmm. And then really trying to up the darkroom stuff, trying to really, I'm annoyed with myself that I have not been as dialed into that as I want to be. And I'm figuring out that like, it will take as much or as little time as you want. Like you can fill up every hour with it or you can fill up no hours with it. And that's the problem.
Sure.
So I need to really just kind of commit to filling in, to making that an important space in terms of how I spend my time.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, Mitch, where can people find you online?
MitchGoldstein.com is kind of my main website. And then I'm on Instagram and Twitter at mgoldst, M-G-O-L-D-S-T.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Jason. It's
great.
It was
great finding out a little bit more about you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Not a problem. Go ahead and hug some necks.
Thank you. All right.
You can find out more about Mitch on Twitter at mgoldst. And be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at CreativeSOPod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CreativeSouthGA, over at CreativeSouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram.
Jack Prince is giving Creative South Podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today.
For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.